Teachable moments. What are they? How do we find them? And how do we not let them slip away? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. It's Monday. This week we're digging back a couple of years for a classic conversation with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. In the August 2007 edition, Bob wrote about teachable moments and how we need to take advantage of them when they occur. Bob, my first question is, exactly what is a teachable moment?
Paul, a teachable moment occurs when a person is confronted with a unique challenge for which an immediate solution to them becomes self-evident. It's really a moment when in a flight student situation, they've discovered or recognized a technique on their own, quite apart from being told specifically what that technique is. It's a moment where it's almost like an aha experience. I see what you mean.
All right, so if I'm going through the Jeppesen book and I'm reading paragraph after paragraph or looking at the little diagrams, I might kind of grasp the subject, but a teachable moment would make it clear to me, just it would be self-evident.
Yes, I remember some couple of years back I was taking some aerobatic training in an extra 300, and I was a flight instructor at the time, but I wanted to just develop some additional awareness and skills in aerobatics. And I went up with a highly skilled F-16 pilot in the back seat, and I was in the front seat, and he said, "Bob, let's just put this extra 300 into a stall." And, of course, I've taught stalls for a number of years, and I've experienced stalls in all forms of training aircraft. So when we brought the power back and allowed the extra 300 to stall, at that moment it became a teachable moment to me, because the bottom of the airplane seemed to fall completely out from underneath me, unlike any kind of a stall experience I had experienced in any kind of a production-type aircraft or normally certified aircraft. The recognition of a stall when it happens in that condition was just overwhelming, and for me it developed a whole new appreciation for what airplanes do when they go through a stall. So a teaching moment or a teachable moment is, again, that specific episode or example or scenario where the student really, you can see, obtains a whole new level of learning.
A Part 141 flight school is kind of analogous to a Cessna 172. It's designed to have benign characteristics, and I mean this in the syllabus sense of things. In other words, a Part 141 flight school is designed to be easy on the student in terms of any abrupt teachable moments, I guess you would say.
Yes, my experience in working in the past with a Part 141 school is there is a lot of pressure, a great deal of pressure, to get the student through the syllabus. And the syllabus is finely defined or very specifically defined, step by step, technique by technique, element by element. So there's almost insufficient time to go through and create the, what I call, the teachable moment scenarios. Instead, it seems to be, on today we have to do, climbs, turns, descents, constant rate, constant speed. And we go out to the practice area and we go through those kinds of exercises. The freedom that many of us have teaching under Part 61, we're not really held to that strict syllabus, and we can create a much more open-ended training scenario. For example, on all of my initial flights with a brand new student, we go someplace. We'll go out on a cross-country trip. We'll do some air work along the way. We'll sit down at the other end, have a cup of coffee, and then I'll ask the student to find his or her way back. And this becomes a teachable moment. They say, I know how to get back from on the ground, but in the air, how do I do that? Well, in order for them to find their way back, to look at ground references, it becomes important that they have the airplane under control. And keep in mind, this is a first-time student, first lesson. And in that experience, they learn a little bit about trimming, and the ability to fly straight and level while they look out the window. Well, their objective, of course, is looking out the window and finding their way home, but the teachable moment occurs when all of a sudden they discover how easy it is to fly straight and level. That becomes a teachable moment. There are just dozens of different examples that we can use. One of the most difficult challenges a new student faces, any new student faces, of course, is learning how to land the aircraft. Well, we'll go out on the second lesson and find a long runway. We have one up at our Niagara Falls Airport. It's a little over 9,000 feet long. And I'll have the student just fly very, very slowly over the runway at about 50 feet, 40 feet, 30 feet, and eventually right down to within about 4 feet of the runway, as slow as possible. Now, they've never landed the airplane in their life, but they develop the ability through pitch and power to keep the airplane flying very slowly, just several feet over this nearly 2-mile-long runway. Well, as things happen, of course, they eventually fall. The airplane settles to the runway, much to their chagrin. That's not part of the exercise. But when that happens, I just make a point that they have just, in fact, landed the airplane. And they said, well, I really didn't intend to land it, but I did land it, didn't I? So the training objective becomes one of just having the student hover taxi, and the resultant objective of learning how to land the airplane. And again, and this is on lesson two, they discover quite by accident. We call this guide to discovery.
Well, now, before people think we're coming down hard on Part 141 schools, I think we should point out that they do serve a purpose. I mean, in my mind, Part 141 is a sort of compromise made by the fact that the FAA has determined through, you know, years of study of aviation that there is a set of skills, minimum skills, a pilot needs to learn to be turned loose in an airplane. And at the same time, you can't spend 200 or 300 hours doing it from an economic standpoint. So there is a point to having a rigid syllabus.
Oh, there's no question about it. We're pursuing two different avenues to achieve the same end. The designers of the Part 141 syllabus, of course, saw the objective of getting through all of the elements in the practical test standards. The approach that we use in the guide to discovery method, or taking a little different approach at it, it's much more line-oriented, if you want to use an airline technique. It's much more of using just basically getting the student out and flying, and as a result, accomplishing the same end objectives using a different method.
My guest is CFI Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back with more on Teachable Moments in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC-700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3020.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We're talking about training techniques that produce teachable moments. And Bob, I have to observe that this idea of basing primary training on cross-country flights puts you at odds with some in your industry. What are some of the practices common in the flight school environment that you're trying to avoid?
I think one is the overuse of the practice area. We up here have several Part 141 schools in our community, and of course I'm up there every day and I'm listening on the radio and I'm seeing where the other aircraft are training, and more often than not I hear calls coming out of the practice area or one or two very nearby local airports. And I recognize the registration numbers on the airplanes. Meanwhile, the training that I like to do is mostly cross-country training, where we get our students out on much longer trips. I have more time during the day to do it because I'm not busily trying to get a number of students through the training day. I can take one student, for example, and go out on a 6-hour exercise. And not worry about tying up a training aircraft that might be in need by somebody else in the flight school. The other thing that we try to do is get them up in real weather. And the local Part 141 schools, their operating specifications restrict them to not fly when winds are up at certain levels, whereas I tend to take the students out into a more aggressive weather. It's certainly safe. It's within the operating limitations of the aircraft. We have adequate back doors, but it's much more realistic training. Now, that's a personal style on my part. I'm not saying that flight schools are being unnecessarily restrictive. I'm just saying it's a different kind of an experience where I prefer to go out into the real sky. The flight school sometimes will go quickly into the flight simulator to achieve what their learning objectives would be that I would do out in the weather.
Well, now, tell me, as a flight instructor, do you find yourself, and I think I know the answer to this, but do you ever find yourself in situations where it's a tough call on whether you continue and give the student this kind of real-world experience, or whether the risks to both the student, the aircraft, and maybe even your certification might be greater than the goal?
Oh, Paul, there's no question about it that safety is job one. There can be no circumstance under which an instructor would take a student, or himself for that matter, out into a weather situation where the outcome would be in doubt. We do a lot of wintertime instrument training, for example, here up in Buffalo, and we wrestle with the issue of icing, known icing conditions, freezing clouds, and things like that. We have to continue the training as best we can in the circumstances that we have. But whenever weather dictates a scenario or a situation where the outcome might be at risk, we cannot do that.
Well, but tell me, are there not risks? I think what you're talking is about managing risk and actually finding acceptable risks in which to put a student.
Well, let's take crosswinds, for example. This is a very, very important area. We know that most, fortunately, non-fatal accidents occurred during the landing phase of the flight. And if we tease out the data, we will often find that winds or crosswinds were a factor in looking at the contributing factors to that accident. Yet we have a number of instructors in flight schools that will restrict their crosswind training to some low-level number, 8, 9, maybe 10 knots. The crosswind, demonstrated crosswind capability on most of the trainers that we work with are 15 to 17 knots. So more often than not, I'll try to find a crosswind runway that we can operate on when the winds are blowing across that runway, right at the demonstrated crosswind capability of the airplane. And then teach the student, of course, that we are not committed to a landing. We can take a higher wind level and just see if we can track the runway without even coming down onto the runway surface. And then once we're convinced that the student is able to determine that he or she can keep the airplane just tracking over the runway in a higher crosswind, then we'll take it to the next step. We'll have them just come down and just touch the upwind gear to the runway. No commitment to landing, we'll just touch it and then take off again. And after a series of that, both the instructor and the student develops an appreciation for how well they can control the airplane in a crosswind, in a rather high crosswind, without committing to putting the airplane down on the runway and run a mishap on the runway. This technique is very effective. Another technique that we use sometimes is the intentional balloon or bounce landing. Just before soloing a student, they will convince me and themselves that they can absolutely land the airplane safely 5 or 6 times consecutively without the instructor becoming involved. And just about the time they're ready to be signed off, I will surreptitiously give a tug on the yoke or the stick, right just as the wheels are touching the runway. This causes the airplane to balloon fairly aggressively upwards, and I sit there just momentarily seeing or observing what the student does. And if there's a hesitation or a delay on the student's part in instituting the correct control recovery technique, then we go back to doing some more practice before signing that student off for solo. Sometimes I will compliment a student who is making or having difficulty with landing, saying to them that I really appreciate the fact that we are bouncing along here. You save me the time of having to artificially bounce the airplane.
Well, that's kind of, well, I think they call it a left-handed compliment.
Yeah.
But let me ask you, if somebody has gone through a fairly conservative flight training regimen, and gets to the point where they have their private pilot certificate and is not confident in crosswinds or is not confident in any kind of iffy weather, is a flight review, and I won't call it a biennial because the FAA wants us to think of them in terms of annually now, but the flight review, is that an appropriate time to seek out that kind of extra instruction?
Well, it sure is, and that's minimally the time. I would, if a student comes out of the flight training experience and has a newly minted certificate in his or her pocket and feels somewhat intimidated by crosswinds, I wouldn't wait until an annual flight review or biennial flight review. That student ought to find an instructor either within the school he or she graduated from or another instructor and go out and say, hey, listen, I'm just a little uncomfortable with crosswinds, and receive several hours of training in that. An instrument student, similarly, may come out of a training experience where they had very little real IFR weather. This happens a lot, of course, in the South, in Florida, Arizona. Understandably, they just don't receive a lot of IFR weather. That student should seek out an experienced instrument instructor and find days where they have low IFR and go out and shoot approaches. Students who fear wintertime flying, they may have taken their training in the summer. This, again, applies more to instrument students where the weather conditions were decidedly different than in the winter. Find an experienced CFI and a capable airplane and go up in the cold clouds and observe the conditions that produce airframe icing. I'm not suggesting they deliberately go into them, but they can see them, they can observe them, they can see where their back doors are. One of the best techniques any student, any private pilot can do is to obtain an advanced rating, obtain their instrument rating. Mm-hmm. If they want to fly smoother, go for their commercial rating. That'll put a lot of fun back into the flying experience. Get some formation flying training. That's a great way to develop good sharp stick and rudder skills. Fun rating would be a seaplane rating. There's endless ways that we can go out and create our own teachable moments after we've completed the basic training.
License to learn, unquote.
Absolutely.
Bob, we really appreciate your input. We'll invite our listeners to go to overtheairwaves.com, take a look at the latest issue of the newsletter, and if they want, they can put their email on the list to get a notice whenever a new one becomes available. And we will talk to you again next Monday.
Thank you, Paul.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.